Welcome to your Aged Care Compass podcast. We help you make sense of the Australian aged care system by having conversations about topics you've asked us about. We're joined by thought leaders, professional experts, and people just like you and I who talk about their experience in the aged care sector. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's show. I'm Coral, your host, and today's guest almost needs no introduction. However, Paul Sadler is joining me today, and he's an experienced leader and influencer who brings an extensive range of experience from nearly four decades in the aged care sector. He's been a national and state CEO of aged care industry associations, CEO of a major aged care provider, and influencer of aging policy, disability and community care programs for both national and state governments. Paul runs the aged care consultancy business, Paul Sadler Consultancy, and is the co-founder of Invox, a new voice for the support at home sector. Paul, it's been a busy year for the sector in preparation for support at home, the stop and start again commencement dates, and the 11th hour updates from the department, meaning providers have been kept on their toes right up until November the 1st. What have you heard from providers over the past few weeks regarding their position on support at home?
Thanks, Coral. Look, it's a sector that is just really anxious to get to the 1st of November, wave it goodbye in the rear vision mirror and move on. But from nearly everyone I talk to, there's genuine nerves and concern about, have I done everything that I need to do to be ready for the 1st of November, ready for the start of the support at home program? But from many others, there is a sense of, let's just get started. We don't want any further delays. We're not asking for another timeframe delay. We want to get into the new system. We've briefed staff, we've briefed our consumers and communicated the change to them. In some cases, providers are telling me, we already did that back in June. We've had to redo it in the past month. Yeah, and so I think everybody's just wanting to get the 1st of November over with at this time.
I agree. I've been talking to lots of providers as well, and I have the same feedback as what you've just discussed, in that the providers are as ready as they possibly can be and just want to hit the ground running and start, make a start now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what have you heard from providers about how their clients or recipients are responding to support at home at this time?
So firstly, many clients are pretty unworried, but that's not surprising given many of the existing home care package clients, of course, if they were a client of home care or had been assessed before the 12th of September 2024, they have the no worse off principle guarantee. And for those clients who've started on a home care package before the 1st of November, but after the 12th of September, then they have a guarantee to continue to receive their home care package level of funding when they transition to support at home. So many of the existing clients are not that concerned, and the response of some of them has been, well, thank you for telling me all this information. I don't think it's going to change my decisions on the sorts of care I need, etc. However, there is, generally speaking, a high level of ignorance and indeed confusion around what is going to be a very complex system. So these, you know, when you talk to older people as a general group, and I've done some discussions with groups of older people who either have been home care package recipients or are interested in it. They might be getting a CHSP service at the moment or wondering what's happening with that. and you begin to talk about how the support at home program's operating, and you can see their eyes glaze over as you begin to get into the detail, because this is inherently a complex set of arrangements that the government's putting in place.
Yeah, I have a couple of presentations this week, and over the weekend I was redoing my slides, trying to, and I've given these presentations earlier this year, and I just kept looking at them and the volume of information that I wanted to get across, and I was trying to make it as simple as possible, and it was really challenging me.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent you have to get into the detail.
Yeah.
Because much as you might want to just give an overview of it, where people would get caught is on some of the details around, for example, how the different short-term pathways are going to operate, how that compares with your ongoing classifications. And of course, the whole structure of the system is, you know, markedly different from how home care packages operate now. So, yeah, it does take some explaining.
Well, that brings us to our next talking point. And I'm surprised when I see this conversation come up so close to the beginning, the commencement, the rollout of support at home. So the confusion that we're still seeing is actually from within the sector about the grandfathered group and the transitional or the new groups that will be entering from November the 1st. One misunderstanding we've seen is that some providers are still unaware that the grandfathered group retains their protected status, in particular in terms of the co-contributions, if they are reassessed for a higher classification from November the 1st. So taking this opportunity to have this discussion with you today, can you please clarify for any of the providers who might be listening into this episode that the people in the grandfathered group will either not pay anything, those are the age pensioners who weren't contributing, or will continue to pay a co-contribution but at a reduced rate, which are the part pensioners or the self-funded retirees, if they are reassessed for a higher classification in the future?
Yes, I can confirm that what you say is true. The Support at Home Program Manual version 4.1, which was released within the last week, confirms that grandfathered home care package care recipients, i.e. those who were approved or were already receiving their package before the 12th of September 2024, will retain that transitional contribution arrangement even if they're reassessed to a higher support at home classification in the future.
Thanks, Paul. And following on from that point, we're hearing from people who are recalculating what they may have to contribute in terms of their hourly services. And in the grandfathered group, people are saying that they're losing about an hour of support each week due to the increased cost of services as an offset to the decreased care management fee. Can you comment on this, Paul?
So it's absolutely true that service providers are increasing the service unit prices they are charging, usually by around 30 to 40%, to offset the loss of package management revenue and the halving of care management revenue by the government. This affects all support at home participants, grandfathered or not. In some cases, this could affect the amount of units of service the former home care package recipient receives. And I assume that's some of the people talking to you who've been in that position. Where that is the case, then the provider should have had the discussion with the person affected as part of signing a new or an extended support at home service agreement. However, it's not the case for everybody that would happen, that they might lose hours of service. In other cases, for example, where a home care package recipient wasn't using all of the HCP funding and was actually building up unspent funds, there may actually be able to be increased units of service provided. So it's going to be on individual circumstance basis whether or not the increase in service unit prices leads to a problem with the amount of care you're actually delivered.
Yes. We're also hearing from people who are saying that they will decline services or forfeit their home care packages because they can't. This is obviously not the grandfathered group, but there are some people now who have been assigned their home care package in the recent weeks and months, saying that they can't afford the co-contribution, so they're actually looking at forfeiting that home care package. The sector has been warning of this for some time. How do you think this will play out over the next few months? What are you hearing?
Well, the first thing to say is this is a very real risk, especially for personal care, which is usually a service you have to receive multiple times a week. That's sitting in the independence category of services. So it's going to attract a 5% co-contribution towards the cost of the service from a pensioner, ranging up to a 50% contribution from a self-funded retiree. And it's going to affect all of the everyday living services, meals, domestic assistance, because those services are going to attract a 17.5% contribution to the cost of the service from an aged pensioner and ranging up to 80% of the cost of a service from a self-funded retiree. It is difficult to predict what's going to happen with support at home participants overall, because there are some pluses and minuses here. On the plus side, those same people won't have to pay anything for clinical care services such as nursing, allied health and the like. So it's going to depend whether what they perceive they're going to get the value for is sufficient from joining the support at home program and getting their packages from there. And the other thing is, of course, even with the grandfathered home care package recipients coming into support at home program, we're going to have probably close to 200,000 older Australians transfer into support at home with the no worse off principle guaranteed. So for it to have a substantial impact on individual providers, I think we're going to have to wait some months until the program really begins to fully bed in. And you've had people like the Inspector General of Aged Care, Natalie Siegel-Brown, saying that she identifies the risks of the participant contribution regime as quite high. So she's going to be looking out for what's actually happening with this area over the coming months and years.
Do you think there is any possibility that the department could rewind this aspect, the co-contributions?
I absolutely think there would be pressure on the government to do so. We've already seen a lot of media coverage in the last few weeks about the participant contributions regime. That's continuing this week, and I suspect will only go up a notch once the contribution rates have to actually start being paid by older people. But the reality is it's unlikely to be a departmental decision on this one, because ultimately it's the central agencies, Treasury, Finance, who have said this is the bucket of money you have. We have assumed that bucket of money is available with the participant contributions being made. Remember, the participant contributions under support at home are not extra revenue for providers. The government subsidy is reduced by the amount the participant pays. So ultimately, this will be a political question for the government, and it's going to depend how much pressure they are put under by older people who ultimately are voters, and whether either of the major parties, who remember both backed the aged care reform package that supported home is a part of, whether one of them breaks ranks.
Thanks, Paul. That was an excellent explanation of that point. Another question that we have from a recipient, and it relates to the hardship provision. What means are taken into account with means testing? Is my family home excluded from the means testing for the co-contributions under support at home?
So to take the second part first, yes, the family home is excluded, so it does not count. The Services Australia conducts income and assets assessments, and the government has chosen to basically use the same income and assets assessments as are undertaken for age pension eligibility for the aged care system access. So the same sorts of questions that Services Australia would be asking of people who are in receipt of a full or part pension will be the same information that they're basically assessing for the aged care eligibility. So where a participant has hardship paying that amount, they can apply for a fee reduction supplement. There's an aged care claim form for this, which the government makes available via Services Australia. And I would imagine that many older people will be lodging those claims for financial hardship assistance in coming months.
We've heard that providers are trying to assist their recipients with applying for that financial hardship now, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you have better intelligence than me on this point, is that they can't do that. Well, you know, they haven't been able to do that until November the 1st. So if that was the case, and in fact, the first few weeks, couple of months into support at home, I think Services Australia might be flooded with applications for financial hardship assistance. Is there some apprehension from providers about the continuity of service provision and the time taken for Services Australia to assess these applications?
Yes, it's the short answer. There is some apprehension about providers about the timeliness of the assessments of hardship applications. It's absolutely true, as we said on the previous question, that Services Australia is going to receive additional applications for hardship under support at home compared with home care packages, because participant contributions are mandatory under support at home. But most participants will continue to be full or part pensioners, not self-funded retirees. So those really high-level contributions we were talking about earlier, the 50% for the independence category services, the 80% for the everyday citizens, are not going to apply to very many people in the sector. But it's equally true that some of the difficulty paying the fees may be coming from people who are full pensioners, mm-hmm. who are facing particularly that 17.5% contribution towards the costs of a service under the everyday living category. So this is going to be a challenge for people. The government's instructions is that providers must continue to collect contributions unless a full fee reduction has been approved or an application is pending. So if you put the application in, you don't have to continue to charge. When the application is approved, the supplement reduces or waives participants' payable co-contribution. Providers and participants are then notified of the outcome, and the Australian government funds any waived portion.
Excellent. Thanks for that clarity, Paul. So Kim has asked a question. What is the best model for managing associate providers?
So associate provider is the new term that the new Aged Care Act applies to third party contractors or brokered services, as some people have called them over the years. And the fact that they're recognised in the Act and they have a defined role and there are reporting obligations on providers to notify the Aged Care Quality and Safety Commission of which third-party providers or associated providers they are actually using. So that will all become publicly available information over time. Under the Support at Home program rules, you can look this up if you want to, in section 5.4 to 5.6 of the Support at Home manual. The best way to manage an associated provider is to have a formal subcontracting arrangement under a lead provider framework. This is where the registered provider very clearly retains full accountability and overall governance of the delivery of the services by the associated provider. In turn, the associated provider delivers services under those strict contractual and operational controls with appropriate oversight, reporting and compliance, which aligns to their obligations or the registered provider's obligations under the Aged Care Act and the Support at Home program.
Community pharmacies keep Australia healthy. With 6,000 locations nationwide, they're open early, late, and longer for convenient, accessible, and safe care. Pharmacists provide home medicine reviews, dose administration aids, and essential vaccinations. Thanks to additional training, many can now treat common conditions like ear infections, wounds, and skin issues. They also support management of chronic conditions in partnership with your healthcare team. Ask your pharmacist how they can help you and your family stay well.
There's another question, Paul, here, and the confusion arose in a team from a provider about the nutritional supplements such as Sustagen or Fortisib and Suvinaid, which are currently prescribed by clients, dietitians or GPs, and are being funded from the recipient's home care package funding. The question was, our understanding is that Services Australia will no longer fund these supplements under Support at Home without having facilitated the application for enteral feeding supplement form, the AC011. So when this was put to us, our take was that it was a misunderstanding about the two situations. You know, one, that was a person may need these dietary supplements and that they can retain the ability to take those supplements orally. And then, of course, when a person loses the ability to safely swallow or maybe unable to swallow at all, then they are nasogastrically fed or PEG fed, which is the enteral feeding component of that. So given this question had just come to us, I thought the opportunity to have a chat with you today would be a good one for you to, I guess, clarify the misunderstanding about the supplements and then the enteral feeding component.
Yes. Well, the first thing to say, Coral, is you are correct. The requirement to use the application for enteral feeding supplement AC011 form only applies to enteral feeding. As the name of the supplement would suggest, it doesn't apply to standard oral nutritional supplements prescribed for home use. So those examples, Sustagen, Fortisib, Suvinaid, they remain eligible under the Support at Home as prescribed nutritional products. That's listed in the service list. And as such, they can be funded from the Support at Home program. The only time you need to complete the enteral feeding supplement is if you are going to be delivering that nutritional food via PEG or gastric tube.
Wang's question here is, with the introduction of fundamental support, what lessons can the CHSP program provide to the disability sector? Do you think the CHSP program has proven itself and is here to stay albeit with some adjustments?
Well, the first thing to say is that the disability sector is having to reinvent the services the former home and community care program used to provide younger people with disabilities, because the NDIS has demonstrably failed to adequately deliver those sorts of foundational support services. So the federal government's, if you like, having to go back into the disability system and try and re-establish what used to be state and territory government run disability programs, so that people with relatively lower level needs can get the assistance they need and deserve, and often are really important to prevent higher level service use further down the track. So that early intervention approach. The role of CHSP in the aged care system has always been that it provides entry level, low barrier entry to the aged care system. And CHSP is very successful. You know, it provides care and support to 835,000 older Australians, which is 60% of the 1.3 million people who use the formal aged care system. And what the government's trying to do with the NDIS now is reinvent that same system. I think there are some lessons for the government. It has an announced intention to roll CHSP in together with support at home. Now, I don't believe that every service should be individually funded, and we disband CHSP at our own risk, in my view. I believe CHSP should be retained, but it's not a perfect system. There are changes that need to be made, and better integrating it with how support at home works would be a starting point for that. And we might come back to that point a bit later.
Oh, I was just going to say we could have a whole episode on that point, couldn't we? We have another question from Lo, and she says, we're hearing so much about the challenges in the new supported home program, but I'd love to know if there are any positives and opportunities for providers or associate providers and our older people come November the 1st.
Lo, really good question. And there are absolutely some pluses in the supported home program design, which smart providers will use to their and to their participants' benefit. So some of these include the fact that there will be immediate access to higher cost assistive technology and home modification services available, because we have the AT and HM scheme set up as a separate stream of funding from ongoing classifications under support at home. So giving people early access to that important home mod support assistive technology will undoubtedly help many older people. Secondly, there are no participant contributions required for clinical care services. So that is going to act as an incentive to provide appropriate clinical care services where the older person needs them. Thirdly, an end-of-life pathway is being made available for the first time under support at home. So that is an important step forward and very welcome. And finally, there are limits to rollover between quarters in your budget. That's got some downsides, but one of its big upsides is it's going to encourage greater regular use of support at home funding. And that, plus the fact the 8 classifications under support at home will allow better targeting of need than just 4 home care package levels, should be an advantage for older people and for providers.
Excellent. Thank you, Lo, for that question. And thank you, Paul, for those very positive answers to Lo's question. So the next question is, Coral, can you please ask Paul to clarify how we track and then bill care management in the end-of-life pathway when there is no separate code, unlike the restorative care pathway, which has its own care management code?
So the first thing to say about this is the questioner is correct. Care management is not separately billed within the end-of-life pathway, so it doesn't have a separate code. So to the best of my understanding, I'll explain how you do get paid. So care management costs are going to be built in to the end-of-life pathway as part of the bundled funding that's made available. Providers will receive an episode-based amount covering all clinical, independence and coordination activities for up to 16 weeks, and it's up to $25,000 worth of funding. The Support at Home Manual, and you can look it up, it's section 8.10, specifies that the care management account only applies to ongoing classifications. The manual states that providers must not claim against the care management account for care management activities provided under restorative care pathway or the end of life pathway. While restorative care pathway has its own care management code, the end of life pathway doesn't. So the way to go about this practically is record the care management time and activities in case notes and service logs, so you've got it there for any audit that might occur. Don't create a separate claim line for care management under end of life, but you bill under the end of life pathway episode funding as part of the overall claim the provider makes to Services Australia for the end of life pathway. And a practical approach here: track time internally for quality and workforce cost analysis purposes, but submit a single bundle claim for the pathway episode. All multidisciplinary activities, including care coordination and family liaison, are deemed to be part of the pathway's integrated funding.
Also billing care management by care partners arranging basic or low-risk assistive technology and home modifications, such as a dosette box, which does not need prescription, can we please have some clarity on the codes? We are allowed to bill up to 10% of the total cost, or $500, whichever is lower for assistive technology, and up to 15% or $1,500, whichever is lower for home modifications. But I am not sure which code to use. I think it is serve 0068, as I think the RAP codes are only used by Allied Health, but I am honestly not sure.
So the
question.
Yeah. The answer to this one is the person is correct. The dosette box without prescription, the correct approach to use is to claim via the serve 0068 code and to apply the 10% or $500 cap as the allowable administration fee. I'll just expand on this briefly. The Support at Home Program Manual confirms that you can claim up to 10% of assistive technology costs or $500, whichever is lower, for administration and coordination activities. And it's up to 15% or $1,500 for a home modification. These percentages cover the provider time spent arranging quotes, ordering equipment, confirming suitability, coordinating installation. It doesn't include any clinical prescription or assessment. So the correct code for claiming the coordination activities is the serve 0068 code. But that's for activities performed by care partners or other staff. Where an allied health professional is asked to prescribe a piece of technology, for example, the RAP codes apply. So they are serve 0065 to serve 0067. So the RAP codes of the allied health professionals and the prescription as the administration and coordination activities that the care partner or other staff undertake are captured in the administration and coordination code serve 0068.
Excellent. Goodness me, that was a very tricky and detailed question and answer, Paul. Thank you so much.
A very technical question.
Yeah, technical. Yes, it was very technical. So, Ben, we've arrived at your question. This is the question that Ben Happ put to both of us. It's a night in early November and the supported program has now gone live where Paul and I and everyone homes are relaxing, watching the news when Minister Butler appears magically on our TV and he tells us that we can add and eliminate one aged care rule. Ben says, what would they be and why? So, Paul, I'm going to let you go first. What would be one aged care rule that you would love to add and why, and one that you would like to eliminate as well?
And I'm going to cheat a bit and add one that I would like to change so it's not completely eliminate.
Same. Okay.
Yes. So, first, the one I would add. Well, I would add a rule that allows a CHSP service to be accessed by support at home participants as an alternative to having been managed via an individualised budget. Now, this would require a mechanism for the CHSP provider to be recompensed from the support at home program without any additional hurdles for the older person. So it would take system redesign, if you like, but many older people move into supported home already using their CHSP services, and all they wish to do is get more of the CHSP services that they've come to love. So a rule that actually enables that to happen simply without lots of extra red tape around it would be a very welcome one. Then what is the rule I'd change? Well, I would be doubling the $15,000 cap to $30,000 for home modifications. The reason for that is the costs of undertaking home modifications are significantly increasing. Anything to do with the construction industry has got significantly more expensive post the pandemic. And I just simply think, as do many people in the home modifications OT areas, that a $15,000 hard lifetime cap is ridiculously low. Third, what's the one that I would eliminate? I would eliminate the time frame limit of 16 weeks on the end of life pathway. If you've been diagnosed as dying, then I don't think there should be an end point where you cut people off from a higher level of service. I think that's a pretty stupid decision. The creation of the end of life pathway is very welcome, but the limit on how long you can use it for doesn't help anybody, in my view.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to agree with you on your points about doubling the cap on home modifications. I completely agree with you on that one, and also the time frame for the 16 weeks at end of life. So we're certainly aligned with our thinking there. But in relation to what I would add, obviously it's going to be in relation to aged care assessments. So the integrated assessment tool, or the IAT, relies on eligibility criteria that is aligned with functional ability and cognitive capacity. So an experienced clinician understands comprehensive assessments, and we complete these kind of assessments similarly to how the IAT predicts a level of care. We do this week to week in the kind of work that we do. So given that there are 121,000 people waiting for an aged care assessment at this time, and it's taking up to 9 months to be assessed in some locations, my rural inclusion is to allow clinicians a kind of an associate aged care assessment role that we can complete comprehensive assessments within the single assessment system. So there are plenty of experienced nurses and aged and allied health professionals within our community now who are able to assist in reducing the wait times for the single assessment, comprehensive assessment. So Minister Butler, I would love to see you create some magic to allow this to happen. And then what I would like to eliminate, again, in terms of assessments, so the circumstances and points for eligibility criteria, currently there are 6 criteria that prescribe the urgency for access to home support. The criteria, however, don't identify diminished function or carer stress, which actually are indicators of higher or urgent need. On the eligibility criteria, a person who lives alone and has a need for urgent access to support and has waited for more than 6 months for an assessment, that's actually quite a lot of people at this point in time, is determined as urgent, whereas a person who has a spouse who is equally impaired, but because as a couple, they don't live alone, would be determined a medium priority. So that we know that being a carer or being a spouse or an adult child, you can't maintain that caring role indefinitely, and it does take a big toll. So an older person who is part of a couple is also at a high risk of adverse outcome, such that if that spouse or that adult child can't continue in that caring role, that older person will end up in hospital. So what I would like to do, I would like to remove that portion of the rules, and I'd actually like to rewrite it. I'd like to revise it and rewrite it. So in this wonderful magical world that Ben is giving us a glimpse into, it would be fantastic if you and I and maybe some of our colleagues were able to literally get our hands into the rules and just adjust them a little bit.
I'm sure if we wrote, they'd be much better.
They'd be so good, wouldn't they? They would. In all seriousness, today has been an absolutely wonderful conversation with you, Paul, and how busy you are, but that you've taken the time to chat with me and answer all these questions from the community, from recipients, and from providers themselves. I say thank you to you on behalf of everybody that's contributed to the episode. So as we have stepped into this brave new world of support at home, I'm wishing everybody lots of courage and resilience over the coming weeks and months, you included, Paul, and thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode. Do you have a topic that you'd like us to cover on an episode? Please reach out and let us know via social media or our website, cmeacn.com.au. That's cmeacn.com.au. All the links are in the show notes. And don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button so you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes.